With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. Bill Handel here the day before Thanksgiving on Wednesday, November 23rd. The big story that we're covering is the shooting in Virginia at a Walmart. A store manager, we are now being told, is being reported, just walked into a break room and opened fire, killing six people and four hospitalized. And then he turned the gun on himself. That's another one. That's now, that's what, 3 days ago was Club Q. So maybe we're going to go to maybe every 2 days now. What do you think? And then every day we get one. And would anybody be surprised? I mean, it is really distressing and very disturbing, to say the least. Now, here's an issue I want to share with you, something that we all share our concern about, and that is homelessness. And almost every day I'm doing some kind of spin on homelessness because it's just a huge issue here in Southern California, in California in general. Throughout the United States, but we're sort of the poster child area. I mean, we are ground central for homelessness to the point where if you, it doesn't matter where you go in the city, you're seeing some encampments within just a mile or two. The governor, Governor Newsom, when he first ran, homelessness was his number one issue. Karen Bass, just elected mayor of Los Angeles, ran against Rick Caruso. Both their primary campaign promises and their platforms was dealing was with homelessness. And so what happened? Let's just talk about Karen Bass, because what she has given, she's been given a mandate that is physically, humanly impossible to finish. Matter of fact, even, well, start maybe. Okay, so let's go back to the election. And one of the measures that we voted in the city of Los Angeles was Measure ULA, a tax on real estate transactions of more than $5 million. And that's going to generate about $600 million or more annually. Okay, that's a chunk of money. I mean, there are a lot of houses in Southern California that are worth more than $5 million. I know that's really rarefied air. But if you look at all of the houses and the transactions over $5 million, you'd be surprised. So we now have a tax that is, we are going to use that money for homelessness. Okay. So I want to give you a couple of stats. A survey was just done, and it was released yesterday. And I want to share with you some of the results and then start commenting on them and just take that information and spin it a little bit. Okay, 89% of city voters said they expected our new mayor to reduce homelessness by at least half during the first 4 years of her term. Half, 50% homeless approval. I mean, homeless reduction. Okay, a majority think that should lead to a decline in 2 to 4 years. Well, I think it's going to lead to a decline. The issue is how much a decline. 20% thought it would happen in a year. Okay. More than 60% say they would actually recall the new mayor, Karen Bass, if she failed to effectively address homelessness within the first 2 years of the office. And, you know, I mean, this is 10 pounds in a 5 pound bag. How the hell does she do that? Even with money, it just takes a lot more time. Are you talking about building shelters? Are you talking about building housing? What does that mean? Well, we have to address homelessness. And we're hearing from Angelenos that we want to deal with homelessness. Of course we do. Who doesn't? Because it has reached every part of Southern California. And according to one of the leaders, let me see what organization he's with, the Weingart Foundation, who actually paid for the survey and the guy who's head of it, he said, we're going to be very focused on what you deliver. This is to Karen Bass. And looked at the answers. People are increasingly willing to make sacrifices. right? Homelessness, now a universal experience. It's no longer just in certain parts of the town, he says. It's as common as sunshine, palm trees, and traffic. How do you disagree with that, huh? Three-fourths of the respondents said they'd be willing to give the mayor full power to dealing with housing for the homeless. Two-thirds said they're willing to forego some environmental restrictions. Okay. 70% would support a shelter or apartment for the homeless within a mile of their home. That's interesting. Is it 200 yards or is it the far end of the mile? Yeah, I wish they'd ask geographical location. It goes on and on. But I think the bottom line here is there's going to be money there. Karen Bass has viewed this as a priority. The first thing she'll do, she said, is declare a state of emergency dealing with the homeless. I don't know what even that means when a mayor does that, what legal significance that is. But I think the most interesting part is the majority of Angelenos say she either has 4 years, actually a good percentage says she has 2 years to fix the homeless problem or at least make some serious inroads. You can't do that. You can't. It's impossible. They might as well ask her to pole vault 48 feet. What difference does it make? Well, at least we know where we're going. I think she's going to give it an honest try. I mean, I don't for a second don't believe, I do not for a second not believe that she's going to put everything she has into the homeless issue. I think she's dedicated. I think she is concerned. I think she's going to go balls to the wall on this. On the other hand, what they're mandating is a physical impossibility. Now, I brought Wayne in on this one because Wayne, of course, having been in the criminal justice system for almost three decades, has a lot of input and has, I like his observations on this. This has to do with a study that just came out with state data. CalMatters got this from the state, and it shows the corrections department transferred patients with serious mental illness basically five times, an average of five times over a six-year period, three times more than the average prisoner. And there's a couple of things. One of them is how can you possibly do this? I mean, you're transferring people from facility to facility, assuming they are in the mental health, I guess in the circle of mental health at the prisons. So, Wayne, your thoughts on this, because the courts have come down on this, the federal court, the state, but primarily the federal courts. And I know that it was unconstitutional to deal with prisoners a certain way. Your thoughts on the mentally ill and how they're being dealt with in prison?
All right. Well, the first thing is you can move a prisoner pretty much anytime, anywhere, for any reason. And prisoners are moved a lot. Well, I mean, I don't mean an individual prisoner necessarily gets moved a lot, but there is prisoner movement from facility to facility constantly. Part of that is to deal with overcrowding. Sometimes you have one location that's overcrowded, a bed opens up somewhere else, boom, you move somebody. You move prisoners around if they are behavioral problems. You move prisoners around if they need a different kind of medical or mental health care. But the problem here is in the big question of how often should you be moving prisoners around, it seems that the prisoners who have the mental health problems are being moved much more frequently on average than even prisoners who don't have diagnosed mental health problems but are discipline problems within the facilities. The mental health prisoners are being moved more often on average.
Okay, I want to now take a defense of the prisons and throw this at you, and this is why I brought you aboard. Is what the prison system is saying is we move people around in the world of mental health depending on the care they need, because it goes all the way from outpatient therapy, facilities, mental facilities, psychiatric facilities, and then those are in a separate kind of a hospital. They're moved in a hospital that's not for the general population, certainly not even within the prison system. And you're talking about the levels, and different prisons have different levels. And as people who are mentally ill go into different phases of mental illness, they're going to that. So it really isn't our fault. We're not doing anything except doing everything right. Huh? Wayne?
Well, this is, yes, this is all very legitimate because it's not addressing some of the underlying problems, the structural problems in the prison system. Absolutely, it's true. Different prisons have different levels of care available. This is true in the California Department of Corrections. It's true in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. You have some locations that are equipped to deal with very severely mentally ill patients, people with schizophrenia, and you have other prisons that absolutely under no circumstances can handle a person like that. So if you have somebody who develops schizophrenia while they're incarcerated, they might have to be moved to another prison. The what's underneath that, though, because what you say is 100%. I can't attack any of it. And they're quite right at this point to say that. But what's underneath it is the fact that why doesn't every prison have the same facilities? And why doesn't every prison have the same availability of care?
Oh, because now, look at the cost. Well, you're going to have a psychiatrist, you're going to have mental health workers in every prison, or you're going to congregate the prisoners who desperately need that help into one facility. I mean, we're just talking money and practicality here, aren't we?
You're talking that, and you're talking security levels as well, because obviously you want to have some lower security facilities for people who don't require a full bore prison. And you need to have very high security, like a Pelican Bay, for inmates that are just a constant problem. And you need facilities in the middle. And if you built every facility exactly the same way, you'd have some facilities with a lot of wasted space. And you'd have, as you said, you might have a psychiatrist sitting at a facility all day, every day with not that much to do. And if you tried to build, we're past this anyway, but if we were able to go start over, if you tried to build every facility is an all-in-one facility, meaning it will have a low security component and it will have a medium security area and it will have a high security wing and it will have a full medical suite and it will have a full outpatient mental health program as well as an inpatient, you'd be spending 10, 20, maybe 30 times as much.
For sure.
To build a facility like that. So the thing with this report that came out, I mean, they are correct in their numbers that patients with mental illness are being moved at a higher rate than other patients. You bring up a really good point, which is patients have different needs, inmates have different needs, and those needs can change over time. You can't have every facility be the same like McDonald's. And so wouldn't those be the kinds of prisoners who might find themselves needing to be moved more frequently? And can I bring up one more? You alluded to it. And that is that the California Department of Corrections was found to be so poor in their providing of mental health treatment in the prison system that it was found by a federal judge to be unconstitutionally bad. And they were placed into a federal receivership. And I have to wonder if some of this moving people around so much is trying to not run afoul of the oversight of the federal courts on them.
Yeah, the reason I bring this up is the study, literally the CalMatters survey or the study of the data just showed up. And they use, and of course, this is done as sort of look what's happening. It's a story that focuses on the case of this guy, Adam Collier, been diagnosed with PTSD, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, anxiety disorder. I mean, this kid was a mess. He was serving a 5-year sentence for exposing himself to women in public while high on meth, moved 39 times between 2016 and 2020, 39 times in 4 years, crisis units, state hospitals, 7 different prisons, and he killed himself in 2020 at Kern Valley State Prison. Now, obviously, that is an outlier case. But, and then I want to finish up with this. Does anything change with this coming out?
No, because simply laying out the numbers and showing that mental health inmates are being moved disproportionately doesn't create a roadmap to do anything about it.
Right.
Here's the thing. This guy, we need to know what was the impetus for each of those 39 movements? It says here in the report that sometimes they put him in crisis units, state hospitals, seven distant prisons. Why? And they don't, I don't know if they didn't bother or were not able to find out what precipitated each of these 39 moves.
All right. That helps. Love bringing in this because then you get to do all the work. See how that is. That's why you're here, Wayne.
All right, buddy.
All right. In a blow to Donald Trump, Supreme Court yesterday nailed him again. The U.S. Supreme Court, even though he nominated and was able to be confirmed three judges, which swung the court super conservative, 6-3 now, you would think that they'd be pro-Trump. They're not. I mean, we certainly look at them and they're very conservative in their view. They're originalists. They are not particularly liberal. Matter of fact, they go the other way. But when it comes to Donald Trump, and this is something that he has a hard time understanding, because what he believes, still believes at, is that it's his government. Mike Pence, you will not certify. But you don't have the authority to do that. Elections, overturn, all of that. But that's I've talked about that plenty. But this one is what happened yesterday. And this has to do not with anything particularly political. Well, I guess that's not fair to say. It has plenty to do with political. But Supreme Court yesterday said to Donald Trump, you must turn over your tax returns to the January 6th committee. As a matter of fact, I don't even think it's the January 6th committee. I think it's the, yeah, it's the investigation of his taxes and his dealings by the House of Representatives. And he initially, if you remember when he ran, he said he's going to turn over his tax returns, like every other presidential candidate has done for 50 years. And then during the course of the campaign, he then said, no, I'm not turning it over because my tax returns are under audit. And when they're no longer under audit, I will turn them over. They weren't under audit. Yeah, he's been audited a bunch of times, but they haven't been under audit. That is sort of an official phrase that the IRS uses. So he has withheld, obfuscated, convoluted, held off, delayed turning over those tax returns. Well, he lost yesterday. It was a four-year battle, and he lost yesterday. And they have to be turned over to the House committee investigating his finances. He lost, right? He won. He won. And I'll tell you why he won. He ran out the clock. New Congress comes in January 3rd. 5 weeks, of which you still have the holiday season. And what's going to happen? Let's say he delays again. He's been ordered to turn it over, but he delays. So you get another order. We don't know when he's going to turn it over. But even then, what does the House do about that? They go ahead and they, I guess, turn it over to the Department of Justice to see if there's any criminality, and there won't be. It has to do with the investigation of his business dealings. And just a quick one, assuming, and I know exactly what would happen, if you look at his returns, I'll tell you exactly what's in them. He hasn't paid taxes in 17 out of the 20 years, legally. I mean, he has some very sharp people. It's not as if he, it's tax evasion, it's tax avoidance. And he took advantage of every loophole the way wealthy people who are very sophisticated do. But the point is, the tax returns themselves that he has held off on turning over are now going to be turned over. But what happens on January 3rd? The Republicans take control of Congress, and this was a House committee. Kevin McCarthy is the new speaker. The first thing that happens is all investigations of former President Trump shut down that day. We're done investigating President Trump, former President Trump. And I'll tell you, on top of that, the investigations start against Merrick Garland and other cabinet members, and even talk of beginning the impeachment of Joe Biden that day. What's good for the goose? You impeach our guy, we're going to impeach your guy. And that's how crazy it has become. So yesterday, there was a huge, big deal made of the former president losing in the Supreme Court. And incidentally, every single case that has gone to the Supreme Court since he has been president on a personal matter, he lost. His election, various aspects of what he was doing, policies of his, he's lost every bit of the way. And this is, I guess, the final blow that's going to happen, because on a political level, it's done. It's all done. You know, we're going to have a new Congress that will not even begin to accept the fact or even accept the notion that the former president has done any wrongdoing. And it's now going to be the Democrats. It's their turn. Now, what's happening in New York? State Attorney General's still going after unfair business practices. They're already doing that with the Trump Organization. I think the Trump Organization is going to be nailed. And we'll see what happens. And if he's running, probably they'll leave it alone until the election. And then if he wins, of course, he's untouchable. If he loses, well, you know, once again, you know, we're back to square one, assuming there is a Democratic Congress. That's what happened yesterday. Oh, isn't that fun? The other big story is that yesterday the Biden administration announced it will extend the payment pause on the student loans. And let me tell you what happened. Obviously, the Biden administration, Joe, President Biden, is really set on that student loan forgiveness plan. Students are overwhelmed in debt. The cost of education has just gone completely crazy. Very few people can afford the tuition, all right, full retail. You just can't do it. And so it's a combination of grants and loans. And the loans, well, they tend to be astronomical. When I got a student loan, and I think I borrowed, $20,000 when I went to law school, and I paid it off over 10 years, just like the plan called for. To get that same education today, if I were in the same position today, it would be $200,000. And paying back $200,000 is no small feat. So he puts forward this loan forgiveness plan, and it's at $10,000 of student loans, and that's for people making under $125,000 a year or couples making $250,000. They have $10,000 of their student loans forgiven. If someone received a Pell Grant, and those are for particularly poor students, then it's a $20,000 forgiveness. Well, as you can imagine, it's considered a pretty liberal policy, and lawsuits were filed immediately to stop it cold. Attorneys general of several states filed, and a conservative group filed, and that has been put on hold. There was a district court judge that put it on hold, and the Supreme Court has said, whoa, we're going to deal with this. And right now, no forgiveness. All right. So with that, the president announced yesterday an extension of the pause that is in place on loan repayments and interest. Through the pandemic, it was all paused. Interest did not increase. I mean, it just was just stopped cold. It was like put in a state of suspended animation. And it was all supposed to start January 1st. All of now the interest rate comes back, and now the repayments, the payments have to come back. So it's as if the pandemic didn't happen. Well, based on that, Biden said, okay, here's my plan to alleviate the burden somewhat. And the plan's not working. It's been stopped right now, cold in the courts. It's going to go to the Supreme Court. And that has to do with whether he has the power to do what he did. And so here's how he's handling it. He said, okay, we're going to extend the pandemic response of no interest and no payments on your student loan from January 1st all the way into June of next year. Here's another 6 months that you don't have to pay. And while this is going on, of course, both sides are reeling, and it's a little complicated because it's either 60 days after, I think, June 30th is when it kicks in. It's the, I think it's June 30th is when the loan repayment, the pause stops, and you have to now begin repaying, but it's 60 days after that. Or when the court makes a decision, and you have 60 days after that, whichever way, whichever one comes first. And so it's going to be months no matter what. And the lawsuits that were filed really didn't have much to do with the borrowers. The lawsuits had to do with simply saying that the president doesn't have the constitutional power to do this. And so now it goes right into politics. And I hate this because the way Democrats paint Republicans and the way Republicans paint Democrats, should this be an argument, a legal argument as to the constitutionality of what the presidential powers are, which have gotten way too much? It used to be the president didn't have anywhere near the kind of powers. You know, the president can effectively declare war. And that's one of the tenets of the Constitution. Only Congress can declare war.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Well, ever since, since the Korean War, certainly the Vietnam War, the president does it all. Is that constitutional? Probably not, because it's not, it's a police action. It's something else than an official declaration of war. Do you know when the last time the United States actually declared war per the Constitution was December 8th, 1941, the day after or 2 days after Pearl Harbor? So here are the politics now, okay? Here is Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Borrowers are drowning under student loan debt, and the Biden administration is throwing them a lifeline as we fight MAGA Republicans in court. See, for MAGA Republicans or Republicans in general, it's all about screwing these students. That's what it's about. It's about making their lives miserable. It's about making sure that they are in overwhelming, burdensome debt that it's almost impossible to pay off. You know, there are lawyers out there and doctors, particularly doctors, that are in debt $300,000, $400,000 by the time they start practicing. I mean, how do you pay that off? And the top Republican on the House Education Committee said, Republicans who have fought to stop Biden's debt cancellation plan are, in fact, fighting the fiscal insanity and accuse the administration of using borrowers as political pawns. How much is this going to cost? Well, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, think they're a little bit biased, opposes the debt relief plan in the first place, estimated that just the pause, the six-month pause that the Biden administration just announced yesterday, and that will, the payment pause until the end of August, because remember, it's 60 days after, could cost an additional $40 billion. You know, one of the things I don't understand about the federal budget is there is a certain amount of contingency money in the federal budget. In other words, here's our budget, $4 trillion, whatever it is. And out of that, there's $200 or $300 billion that is set aside for emergencies, set aside for unanticipated expenses. I don't even care what that figure is. Between the war in Ukraine, $40 billion. Between this that just happened, $40 billion, assuming you apply those figures. Between emergency relief, tens of billions, well, $1 trillion, unanticipated. That one is fairly easy to justify. But this is why we have a $1 trillion deficit. This is why this national debt of ours, I don't understand how it's still up there. I don't understand how we don't go absolutely broke, how this country doesn't declare bankruptcy, which it can't, by the way, legally. States can. Do you know a state can declare bankruptcy? So we're going to keep following this story. Now, I'm going to throw a combination at you, which is not a good combination. The economy, Twitter, Elon Musk. You put those three together and you have a recipe for disaster. Now, We had talked about over the last few days that when Elon Musk bought Twitter, overpriced, by the way, I might add, he spent $44 billion. The experts at that point, the economic pundits, they figured it was worth maybe $25 billion. Now it may be worth less. And what he did is he immediately fired half of the 7,500 staff that he had. And then he gave everybody a choice, the ones that were left. Yes, no, do you want to stay? If you do, you're going to work your ass off. Don't just forget about family. I want excellence. Don't ever bother going home. Yes or no? Well, another 1,200 said, no thanks. And they left. So now what a mess. So he is asking for these employees to come back, and that negotiation is going down. But let me tell you another problem he has. More than a third of the 100 top clients of Twitter have simply stopped advertising in the past 2 weeks. Nah, we're done. 14 of the top 50, including several dozen, have just said no. Jeep, Mars Candy said absolutely not. A statement from Mars saying Mars started suspending advertising activities on Twitter in late September when we learned of some significant brand safety and suitability incidents that impacted our brand. It's just a corporate speak for we ain't going to have nothing to do with this place. Merck, huge pharmaceutical company, Kellogg's, Verizon, Samuel Adams, Boston Beer stopped their advertising in the last few weeks. I mean, the advertisers are, well, Twitter's hemorrhaging advertisers, that's for sure. And there's a company called Pathmatics Data. It looks at all of this social networking or social platforms, the advertising. And the company estimated that each of these top marketers' ads were shown tens of millions of times per week or more during their busiest weeks. And some of the advertiser ads were shown billions of times over the 6 months before the pause. And you think, how hugely successful? No. Let me tell you a little bit about Twitter and what's going on. Wall Street has viewed Twitter as negatively for a very long time, a company that moves way too slowly to push out products that convert its popularity into revenue. And Musk has been scrambling to cut costs and find alternative forms of revenue, but he would have to turn on a dime, which he does, and he did. But the problem is it too late? And here's the problem with Twitter's model, and that is it relies on advertising. And so you're at the beck and call of the advertisers, and politics really gets in the way. In this case, because of Musk, what he did, and because of how he's opening up again. Last year, 90% of the company's revenue, $5 billion, came in from advertising, and the rest was come from data licensing and a few other things. The point is that right now, advertising is not a particularly good way to get revenue. Just Musk buying Twitter and overpaying is in and of itself a real problem. And I mean a real problem for Musk. And so he overpays probably by twice. The financial pundit said at about the time he paid his $44 billion, the company was worth maybe $25 billion. And I'm willing to guess it's worth even less now. And the primary reason is that advertisers are bailing out like crazy for a couple of reasons. One, Musk, and just the way he is running it, the way he has cut. Usually when a CEO comes in and starts cutting expenses, that's a good thing. But I think the way he does it. Now, I'm not a big financial guy, but certainly I can see the fallout. This is way above my pay grade in terms of determining how to run a multi-billion dollar business. But there's cutting and then there's cutting. So you cut 50% of the workforce right there. That's a little problematic. And then you give the rest of the employees a chance to stay or go. And if you stay, here's what we're going to demand of you. You never go home. Forget about your family. You're going to be working 15, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. And 1,200 of them that said, nah, no, no, thanks. And now he is left, 7,500 minus half, minus 1,200, and you're not left with a whole lot of people to run Twitter. And a lot of those 1,200 were critical to the running of the company. So now he's asking for them to come back. God, can you imagine being on the other end of the negotiation with Musk on that one? You want me back? Okay. How about a lot more money? How about I'm an independent contractor and I'll decide what my hours are? What does Musk do? So you've got a problem with the management itself, Musk. You got a problem with the politics. These are advertisers have a problem with the politics. And that is he comes in and says, you know what? We're back to an open platform where this is First Amendment and effectively any crazy can spout any conspiracy. We don't care about, well, it's a First Amendment issue. So that includes anti-Semites. That includes anti-African-American, you know, these government anti-government crazy people, anti-vaxxers. And all of a sudden, advertisers are looking and saying, wait a minute, we don't want any part of that. That's way too controversial. So he backtracks on that one. He goes, well, wait a minute. That's not to say it is a complete free-for-all. That's not to say that we're not going to have, you know, some control and there are consequences. The problem is his some control and consequences people, he fired them all. And so you've got advertisers that are getting out of there just because of that. And you have the economy that they're bailing out anyway. And as I said in the last segment, Wall Street has viewed Twitter as not a particularly good model for a social platform like this. First of all, it's viewed as moving too slowly. It doesn't take advantage of its viral popularity. And here's the difference between Google, Meta, Facebook, is that even though advertising is important, the majority of the money comes from selling data. And that's micro-targeting. And so when the economy goes south, what advertisers do is stop spending on the big platforms, branding, just going and buying those huge billboards, McDonald's just saying, hey, we're the best, or not trying to sell anything specifically. That's the first thing that goes. However, core business has to stay. And if advertisers can use the internet, can use these platforms to micro-target the best possible customers under the best possible circumstances, that's what they're going to do. That'll be the last dollar that is still going to be spent. Well, that's what Facebook and Google do, is they sell that kind of information. Twitter does not. Twitter is a whole different animal. So the people most likely to buy are the people that Google and Facebook are targeting, and Twitter does not do that. They just want ads. So now you have an economy that's also going south, where advertising on these platforms is going south anyway. And so it's a real problem. And what Musk said when he first bought Twitter and he told all of these workers that were left, saying you are going to work your butts off and I want excellence. And if you can't have excellence, I mean, the guy is known as that kind of a boss, as an employer. He demands not only excellence, he fires people at will. I mean, he's very hot headed. He'll admit that. But also, he demands so much that, you know, that's how he ran SpaceX. That's how he runs Tesla. That it's, I was doing this yesterday, and let me put this, I'm trying to put this in the right light, that people who worked at Tesla, who do work at Tesla and work at SpaceX, they do work their asses off. They do, they adhere to these ridiculous demands, but it's something bigger than themselves. The people at SpaceX are part of creating the new space environment, the way we do space exploration and moving people to the moon and to Mars. There's just something there that goes beyond just making money and working so hard. Same thing with Tesla. This is a visionary who created an entirely new way of manufacturing and selling cars, broke in and basically became the EV market around the world. There's something special about that. Twitter, it's just another platform. There's no difference. It's coding. Coding is coding. There's not much to it. And so you don't get the same sense of belonging and a pioneering and doing something important, bigger than yourself. That doesn't exist at Twitter. Wouldn't it, for me at least? And so put all that together and you've got a company that's in a whole lot of trouble. So Musk is now looking at people bailing out, the advertisers bailing out. That's on the financial front. And one of the influences on the advertiser are the civil rights groups that are pushing, the advocacy groups that are pushing like crazy to have Musk turn around his philosophy. Just put Donald Trump back on. Not that Trump's going to go because he has his own, but I think he put Marjorie Taylor Greene back on. Crazy woman, the congresswoman. Conspiracy theories. Sandy Hook was a hoax. My favorite one is the wildfires in California. And I have to always, always give you this disclaimer. I am not making this up. The wildfires in California were caused by Jews controlling satellites that threw lasers down on the ground and ignited the trees. That is a United States congressperson who was thrown off by Twitter because they go, how much crazy stuff can you have? And he reinstates her. So a lot of politics. So he met with civil rights groups because there was a lot of action in that area. There's a lot of pushback. And he then pledged to not reinstate these accounts that were banned until he somehow had a clear process, and it would probably take weeks. And it meant that former President Donald Trump would not rejoin before the midterms, which is true. And then the reason that Donald Trump was asked is that he did an informal poll asking listeners or asking Twitter users, do you want him on or not? And I think he said 52% said, yeah, put him back on. So he did. So you've got full scale backlash and boycotts going on. You've got a company that's falling apart. And what he did is throughout this is this is a typical Musk move, is as there are some problems, and he had huge problems with SpaceX. He almost ran out of money. I mean, he was within one launch of losing everything. I mean, you have to give him a lot of credit for that. Same thing with Tesla. He was in a lot of trouble with Tesla, and he barreled through. But again, Tesla and SpaceX are very different companies. And he threatens to go bankrupt to his employers or his employees. You got to come to the table. We may not be here next week. And he's admitted to making a mistake. As to Twitter, he actually said, as to the purchase, he actually said, sometimes I act too quickly and I don't listen to those people that are closest to me and advise me. Obviously in reference to buying Twitter. Could be the worst deal in a very, very long time. I thought I'd end the show, assuming that I don't finish it this segment, maybe next segment, we can do something else. But I thought I'd end the show with talking about turkey. Whenever you think Thanksgiving, you think of family getting together. You think of, I guess, traveling, because, 54 million Americans are on the road or flying or taking a ship someplace. And, of course, you think of the Thanksgiving meal, and the first thing that comes to mind is turkey. Talking about turkey, tomorrow, Neil Saavedra sits in for me for the whole show, and what he does is help people talk turkey. And that is hints and tips on how to cook, what to do, last-minute stuff. Neil is brilliant at that. Neil is the foodie of all foodies, and he seriously knows his stuff. He does the Fork Report 2 to 5 o'clock, and he and my daughter, who is a serious foodie, will sit down and have conversations. I don't even understand half of what they're talking about. So in the meantime, I'm going to give you a little bit of handle history, a handle history segment on turkey. And you ever wondered why it's turkey around Thanksgiving? Why not ham? Some people do ham. That's usually Easter. Chicken, venison, beef, corn, because, of course, it's all about the pilgrims and sitting down for the Thanksgiving meal, their first Thanksgiving meal, 1621. About 9 in 10 Americans eat turkey at Thanksgiving. Matter of fact, I don't know anybody who doesn't. I mean, occasionally you'll see some outlier who they'll have duck or they'll have a brisket, but it's all turkey. Unless you're a vegan, and then Southern K, then you eat tofu, whatever the hell you eat over there. Do they have anything in the shape of turkeys that's vegan or vegetable, or I don't even know if they do that, where they have turkey presses. I don't think so. So here is, we are believing that turkey is what the pilgrims ate when they landed in what's now Massachusetts. And they met with the indigenous natives, the Indians there, the Wampanoag guests that they had. That was the tribe there. And that was their first Thanksgiving feast. So maybe that's why it all started. They ate turkey. We don't know. Maybe it's because turkey is American. I mean, they eat turkey all over the world, but turkey comes from the Americas. So actually, let me tell you about Thanksgiving and turkey. It actually started in the 1800s is where this really came down. First of all, let's talk about that first Thanksgiving, the pilgrims. There's only one record of what they ate at that Thanksgiving meal with the Indians. And it comes from a guy named Edward Winslow. And he wrote that the Wampanoag leader, Massasoit, I'm so bad at names, arrived with 90 men, a little sexist there, and the two communities feasted together for 3 days, long Thanksgiving meal. He didn't write much about the menu. But what he did say, there were five deer that the indigenous natives brought, and that the meat included fowl. And the way they spell it is F-O-W-L-E, great spelling. And it could have been any number of wild birds. Ducks, geese, turkeys, really don't know. And historians, what we do know, historians will tell you that a lot of ingredients of today's traditional dishes just weren't available during that first Thanksgiving. Potatoes? No. Green beans? No. There was no wheat flour, almost none. There was no sugar at that time. So out goes pumpkin pie, out goes cranberry sauce. Now, squash, that was a staple of the Native American diets. That was certainly on the menu. Along with corn, but their corn was very different than our corn. If you ever see paintings of corn coming from that era, it doesn't look anything like it's these scrawny little ears of corn. Of course, today corn has been modified it's a hybrid of what corn used to be. It's big, wonderful, luscious stuff. Anyway, there was corn and there was shellfish because they're right there on the shore. So the historians who studied the history of food found, as I said, that if you look at the Thanksgiving tradition, and it began in the mid-1800s, and it was largely the work of one person, and we're talking about the celebration as a national holiday, it's really one person that's given credit for all of it. And it's the woman given credit is Sarah Hale. She was born in 1784 in New Hampshire. And she was a young widow, and how she made a living is she published poetry. Can't do that then very much and do well. Can't do that now. And just to give you an idea, you don't know her name, Sarah Hale, do you? However, you may know, remember I told you she published poetry? She published a little rhyme that you might recognize, Mary Had a Little Lamb. If you ever get asked that on Jeopardy, you get the winner on that. So in 1837, she becomes the editor of a magazine called Godey's Ladies' Book. Very religious, family-focused, and it actually crusaded for an annual national holiday of thanksgiving and praise, commemorating the pilgrims. And she assumed that the pilgrims ate turkey because of the number of wild turkeys in New England at her time. And that campaign took decades. Lack of enthusiasm. It really is white Southerners who put a stop to it all because they considered a holiday that they celebrated, and that's the Virginia colonists, and in honor of the supply ships that arrived in Jamestown in 1610. That's the holiday. So 1863, no Southerners in Congress. President Abraham Lincoln is convinced to declare Thanksgiving a national holiday. And Godiz, with all other media, and it was in the North now, celebrated Thanksgiving. And that's how we got it. And there was a chronicle, the Augusta Chronicle, predicted in 1862, every person who can afford turkey or procure it will sacrifice the noble American fowl today. So what are the reasons? Well, roasted turkey is a great centerpiece. A chicken just isn't as impressive. Also, it's good for a large crowd. It's a big bird. It's cheaper to produce a turkey than a cow or a chicken. So the other thing is a Christmas carol, Ebenezer Scrooge, right? So what did he do? He sought redemption by replacing this little tiny goose that the Cratchit family have with an enormous turkey. Pretty neat. 1800s. The woman who wrote Mary Had a Little Lamb, she's responsible for the turkey. Have a good Thanksgiving. This is KFI AM 640 Live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.